You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, October 10th, 2007, and this is your host, Stephen Novella, president of the New England Skeptical Society. Joining me this evening are Rebecca Watson.
Hey, everybody.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Hi, everyone, and a happy World Mental Health Day to all of our listeners.
To all of our Scientology listeners out there.
Oh, good. Does that mean Jay's finally going to get the help he needs?
There is no help for Jay, only, unfortunately.
Only today.
Bob is out this week again.
Oh, my God.
This time, it's his day job work that's keeping him from recording the podcast.
How many weeks
right.
is this?
He's in a cornfield jumping out at 10-year-olds right now, isn't he?
I thought they fired him when they realized what he was doing with his nightlife.
You know, yeah, basically what's happening is he's not working during the day, and he's catching up on hours at night, I'm sure.
Whatever, he's not here.
Bob, you're off the show.
But he promises to be back next week.
You're done.
We have an interview coming up later in the show with Mark Abrams from the Ig Nobel Awards. We'll get the report on the 2007 awards. But first, we have some news items. One of our old friends, Uri Geller. You have to say Uri, not Yuri Geller. Randy's always correcting me on that. Uri Geller, who we've talked about before, his recent comeback. He had a show on Israeli TV where it's like a reality show, like find Uri Geller's heir. The next mentalist to take on his mantle. Well, the show was so successful, even though it was embarrassing to the state of Israel, that NBC decided this would be a good idea to do an American version of the show. So they've paired up Uri Geller with Chris Angel, the mind freak guy, and they're going to have a reality show for a show the working title of which is Phenomenon.
It's a phenomenon that Geller still manages to get a paycheck these days.
It's amazing.
Without like selling used cars. The guy is a joke.
There's a picture of him on NBC, on the NBC website with a bent spoon. He's still a one-trick pony.
You know what, what I'm surprised about this.
Something about this surprises you?
Well, yeah, of course. I mean, first of all, you know, a TV station like NBC, they didn't dive into his history at all and just be like, wow, this guy is not the right person.
Jay, they don't care. They say
don't care.
It made money and they're going to dupe it. That's it. That's all they care
That's
about.
It.
Isn't NBC the station who did like the mysterious origins of man and all that, you know, how to find your angel and all those shows?
I don't know. It's, yeah. it's hard to keep up with what kind of crap the stations are pouring out and from which station it's coming out from.
But he has such a dubious past. They could have replaced him with somebody else, you know, anybody.
But Jay, what is your premise, though, that they care?
Well, that's I guess that's the sad point I'm making, is that they don't care.
No, he's a name. You know, he added the show in Israel. He has a shtick. That's all they care about.
I mean, I'm not crazy about Chris Angel, because he does play into the whole he's got power thing. You know, at least Chris Angel isn't widely thought of as a complete and total jackass.
Chris Angel has been fairly upfront with the fact that he doesn't have real powers. He's a friend of Randy's and Penn and Teller. So it's a little disappointing that he's associating himself with this. And the hope is that he'll stick to the skeptical side. But frankly, hopes are not high.
Yeah, yeah, it's I might be reading between the lines, but it sounds like the way they're playing it is that Chris Angel is going to be screening these, you know, prospective mentalists for, you know, the stage mentalism ability, and Geller is going to be screening them for real psychic ability. So they have like these two different roles in the show. I don't know if that's how it's going to play out, but that's what they made it sound like to me.
Yeah, and they're deliberately not even blurring the lines. They're flat out saying they're looking for people that have sleight of hand ability, and they're looking for people who have psychic ability.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, when it comes down to it, they're after the paycheck. And sadly, I hope we're not seeing a trend here, but I'm kind of getting the feeling that we are, because there's another show I just blogged about that a listener wrote in about the other day on Lifetime, which is pretty much the exact same thing without the big names attached. It's a reality show to find the next, it's called America's Psychic Superstar, something like that. And it's basically ripped completely out of a UK show, which is Britain's top psychic. It's the same sort of thing. They put them through tests, and, you know, they test their cold reading skills and their ability to accurately randomly guess which room a guy is in, stuff like that. And so apparently, you know, this stuff is selling easily enough for them that they're, we've got a number of new shows on this exact topic. So hopefully this will die down. People won't give this the ratings that they seem to think they're going to get from it.
Well, what about a show, America's Best Skeptic? That's Ooh. The reality show that we need. We could.
Oh, yeah. Why don't we just have a bunch of grumpy guys sitting around?
No, we could test people on their cold reading skills, on, you know, ability to name logical fallacies, identified flawed methodology in research, design test protocols for paranormal powers.
I'd like to see a skeptic, actually. I'd like to see a skeptic infiltrate one of these psychic reality shows and cold read his way to
that
the top.
That would be awesome.
And then reveal. Mm, then do the reveal.
Yeah.
Hey, that's a good idea.
I saw them casting. People sent me links to Craigslist. They were casting for Chris Angel's new show here in Boston. So if you live in a major metropolitan area, you can check Craigslist, see if they're looking for any quote-unquote psychics near you.
Yeah, any skeptical mentalists out there.
Obviously, none of us could do it.
The next news item is a quick follow-up on the acupuncture study that we talked about a couple of weeks ago. There's always new acupuncture studies coming out. That's not such a big deal. But this one is interesting because it's using a research technique that I have not seen in other studies, although I knew this kind of thing was in the works. Actually, when I blogged about the acupuncture study and back pain a couple of weeks ago, I mentioned that what we need are truly blinded studies between the sham acupuncture and the quote-unquote real acupuncture. And I suggested a method for doing that. You have a needle in a sheath, you know, you push the sheath against the skin, and neither the person delivering the acupuncture nor the patient knows if a needle or not is then being inserted. And this study did exactly that. They used that method. It was double blinded. This was acupuncture in radiotherapy induced nausea. This is like one of either chemotherapy or radiotherapy induced nausea is one of the main indications for acupuncture where believers say, yeah, the evidence really supports that it works. This is like one of the areas where the evidence is the most positive. And yet I still think that the evidence was weak. This study found absolutely no benefit. So the conclusion, there was no statistically significant difference between the groups in the number of days with nausea or vomiting or the intensity of the nausea, neither in the patients receiving radiotherapy alone nor in those receiving a combination of chemo and radiotherapy. So here, and to put this in context as well, when in talking about these kinds of studies, you have to look at the literature, not any individual study. Although, of course, one really well-designed, very large, like multi-center trial can be compelling in and of itself. You always have to look at these questions in the context of the overall literature. And one of the patterns that we see when you're looking at therapies that don't actually work is that the better designed the study, the smaller the effect seems to be, and the best designed studies tend to have a negative result. And this fits that pattern for acupuncture. This was a good study. It was blinded better than previous studies that I've seen, and it was dead negative. So this, to me, counts significantly against acupuncture having any actual significant measurable physiological effect. It supports what myself and many people feel is that any perceived benefit from acupuncture is incidental. It comes from the fact of getting the acupuncture, you know, the placebo effect, the relaxation effect, the introduction of a novel treatment expectation, etc. Maybe with a mild, you know, effect from the needles being stuck through the skin, although it doesn't matter where you put them. This study shows that it doesn't matter if the needles enter the skin or not. So this moves the evidence one notch more towards the negative and also hits the area where the evidence previously was thought to be the most positive. So I thought that was very interesting. The next study, also a medical topic, we've had a number of emails recently about cell phones and cancer, and there have been a few studies out in the last few months on this topic, so it's no surprise that we've gotten a number of questions. So the question is, does using a cell phone increase the risk of developing either cancer in general or brain cancer specifically. You know, I certainly hope that it turns out that the answer to this question is no. But this is one of those questions where we do not have a definitive answer yet. The epidemiological research is mixed. So when you look at it in different ways, you look at people who have brain cancer and see, is there any differences between their cell phone use from people who don't? If you look at people who use cell phones versus people who don't use cell phones, or different amounts, or one side versus the other, whether or not they develop, have a higher risk of brain tumors is fairly mixed. There was a recent meta-analysis, and this is one of the studies that has prompted a lot of the emails that we've been getting. You know how we feel about meta-analysis. A meta-analysis isn't new data, it's just pooling prior studies. It introduces another layer of complexity and variables that can introduce artifacts into the results. I don't think it really personally adds much to the body of literature. I prefer systematic reviews myself, although they do serve different purposes. So this meta-analysis concluded that for people with greater than 10 years of exposure, that there was a significant increase in certain types of brain cancer, gliomas and acoustic neuromas. Prior studies have not shown a correlation, or not consistently, although the critics said, well, that's because they didn't look for more than 10 years, and maybe it takes time, there's a latency. If you look at greater than 10 years, maybe there will be an effect. This meta-analysis supports the notion that maybe there is a weak effect for use greater than 10 years. Although there was a UK study that was published after the meta-analysis did its analysis, so this data was not taken into consideration. This is a very large study which showed no correlation with cell phones, including for greater than 10 years of use. So the answer right now is there is certainly no strong signal out there, meaning that there is no strong effect or strong correlation between cell phone use, the duration of cell phone use, and brain cancer. If there were, then I think that we would be seeing a more consistent pattern in the research. Again, you have to interpret the literature, not any one study. The literature does not show a consistent pattern. But neither has it been negative enough to say that there clearly isn't any correlation. So I think where we are right now, if you break it up into less than 10 years of exposure, I would say that the results are mixed, but are leaning negative. And if you look at greater than 10 years of exposure, I would say that they're mixed, but they're leaning weakly positive. And everyone agrees that we need more and better data in order to put this question to rest one way or the other.
How concerned should people be, Steve?
Yeah, that's a good question. Again, I think at this point that we should be mildly concerned. I don't think that there's any need to panic. I don't think there's any need to stop using cell phones. What the recommendations from the FDA and the National Cancer Institute and other organizations are all pretty much the same. One is, they all say the same thing. If you are concerned about this, they're not saying you should be concerned. They're just saying, if you're concerned, what can you do about it? Well, you could use your cell phone less. Like, that's not a big reach.
Okay, that's out of the question. Move on.
Yeah, like only in emergencies or...
Yeah, I got people to talk to. What's next?
The next one is get a headpiece or a headphone so that you're not putting the antenna right next to your head. I guess the antenna is where you get a lot of the actual radiation.
Those things look dorky. What else?
There's also a recommendation not to allow small children to use cell phones. But there's no real evidence to back that up. It's purely speculative. It's the notion that their skulls are thinner, their brains are smaller, they're still developing, and if they start using it now, their duration of total duration of exposure will be longer. So they're recommending caution in allowing children to use cell phones.
Well, none of that is any good for me because I just hired a 7-year-old personal assistant and I'm not trading her in.
You got to get her one of those headphones, the headpieces. That's all.
I guess so. Have you ever tried training a 7-year-old how to use one of those things? It's nuts.
Yes, twice.
You know, but first of all, lots of states are passing laws about not driving unless talking on the phone. You know, use a headset. They're actually very, a lot of them are very comfortable and the sound quality is fine. There's just no excuse now not to use a headset.
Yeah. Although the driving laws, of course, are have to do with just driving safety, not about the radiation risk.
Keep the phone on your belt near your groin. You'll be all set.
Yeah.
Wait, can I just say, as a girl, don't do that. It looks so dorky. Okay, go on.
What, the cell phone on the hip?
The cell phone on the phaser. Don't do it.
Trek Next Gen phaser.
Just don't do it.
Where else are you going to wear your cell phone if not on your hip?
Yeah.
Let me ask you a question.
You can carry it in your pocket, in your man purse.
Why won't women wear cell phones on their hip? I don't get it.
Yeah.
Because it looks ridiculous.
But you know what? My wife throws her cell phone in the purse, and then she can't hear it ring. So she
yeah,
doesn't
but she
answer.
Doesn't look ridiculous, does she?
Yeah,
no,
but she doesn't
she
answer her cell phone.
No,
but
she's
just being impractical.
Yeah, and she's not getting brain cancer because she's not answering her phone all the time because she can't find it. There, problem solved.
Or groin cancer.
I'm not going to advocate that people wear, like, fanny packs or anything, but I think this is case where function trumps fashion.
No. It is practically... You are right next to fanny pack.
No. This is totally different.
I know that you've been walking down the street thinking, you know, this phone clip to my belt is cool and all, but wouldn't it be better if I could stick a little bit of money next to the phone or maybe put my keys there? Hey, you know, I should get like a larger sack to carry the phone in.
No, you're missing it. Rebecca, you're missing the whole angle here. First of all, wearing an electronic device on your hip is way cool, okay? That's number one.
You are so confused.
Number two
babe magnet.
You're going in the wrong direction by going towards a fanny pack. We should be going in the utility belt direction.
I agree. Oh, Batman.
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely.
You're a genius.
Yeah, awesome. Yeah, Batman. That's a great idea. Have you considered a cowl while you're at it? A cowl?
Cowl?
A cowl pulled over your face, yes. Maybe
those are only for evil.
Ears.
Those are for villains, not heroes.
No, but you can have...
Batman has a cowl. Hello?
He's the Dark Knight, okay? He's right on the edge.
He's cool.
Just don't do it, okay? It's bad.
You can have like a little like a little change thing on there. You could...
Yeah.
You know, if you can get a really...
The only way an electrical device attached to your hip is going to get you laid is if it's a vibrator, okay?
The utility belt. We got to work on that. We got to think of what goes in the utility belt, how it's going to arrange them together.
A giant dildo.
This is unexplored territory, I'm telling you.
Rebecca, you've seen Star Trek, right? Okay.
Yes.
1966, Captain Kirk getting ready to call Scotty up in the Enterprise. I mean, come on. That's it. That's ever since then.
And he always got the green babes. So that's true.
Every show.
Yeah, well, you know, let me know how many green babes you bang the next time you're out.
Well, I'm married, so it's not a good test. But I was going to finish up this piece by talking about the fact that there are a lot of quack devices out there that promise to protect you from the radiation from your cell phones. These fall into one of three categories. They're completely woo devices that do nothing, crystals or magic or whatever. Two is they pretend to be technological, but they don't do anything. And the third is they actually shield from radiation, but they interrupt the actual signal from the phone. There's no way to shield you from the radiation without shielding the phone from the signal. So there's no device that actually works, even if it says it can do that.
Yeah, other than using, you know, like a headset. That's it.
I want to hold the phone far away and shout into it. That might work.
That's what my mother does.
You know what? I'm surprised that a cell phone company flat out just hasn't come out with a phone that looks like a Star Trek communicator.
They've got to be out there. I think I've seen one.
You know, clamshell, when you open it, you know, the whole bit. I'm in. I'll take a dozen.
More unexplored territory. And you combine that with the utility belt, Jay, and I mean, you know, you're off to the races.
How did you guys ever get married?
All right, the next news item. I really wish Bob were here for this one, but we did chat about it before the show. This item is about the dimensions of the universe. Now, our universe is considered to have four dimensions, three spatial dimensions, right? We live in a three spatial dimensional world, and one dimension of time. So time is one dimensional. We move only in one direction through time. There are some theoretical physicists, those are the people who think about this kind of thing, who now claim that the universe is headed towards a catastrophic event in which the time dimension will become a fourth spatial dimension. So we'll have four physical dimensions and no time dimension.
That's crazy
talk.
Yeah,
I don't even know what the hell you're trying to say here.
I can't even wrap my mind around it.
That's got to ruin your whole day, I would imagine.
It's like
over and over again.
Yeah, right. But yeah, would that be like Groundhog's Day where we just live the same day over and over again?
It reminds me of how Kurt Vonnegut talked about Trafalgarians. I can't pronounce it. In Slaughterhouse-Five, they see time like spread out in front of them. Like portraits on a wall. I don't know. When I try to think, like, what would a dimension without time be like?
You wouldn't be. That's all I've got. I'd imagine you wouldn't be able to perceive it because of the way that we're built.
Would everything happen at once?
Yeah, I mean, you'd be every when.
Right. Would you be immortal then, or would your existence be an instant?
It'd be both.
Immortal wouldn't really mean anything.
It'd be relative, right?
Or is there no way to even describe it?
There's no way to describe it. I mean, this is one of those things.
I guess that's why we have math.
Yeah, mathematically.
Math is the only language we can use to describe it.
So they say this because they've done, again, just their mathematical calculations. They say they did the thought experiment. If this were about to happen, what would the universe look like? And it turns out the universe would be accelerating.
Can't you see them like working over their formulas and they're like, okay, so what do we have? Well, it looks like if this were about to happen, the universe would be expanding at an accelerating rate. Oh, crap.
That's happening to us now. So that's a pretty thin line of argument, in my opinion.
You know, how about this, Steve? It's not going to happen in our lifetime. So
this is probably not something to be high on your list to worry about.
Yeah, and remember, the question isn't when is it going to happen. The question is where.
Well, let's move on to your question in emails. The first one is a follow-up to the 30-year battery discussion from last week. Actually, I'm not going to read a specific email. I had about 5 million emails correct me on a couple of things on the 30-year battery. So one was just a screw-up. I mentioned that tritium is 3 hydrogen atoms. Actually, tritium is a hydrogen atom that consists of 1 proton and 2 neutrons. So it's an isotope of hydrogen. But the big thing was the discussion about mass and energy. And listening back to my discussion of that, I definitely gave the wrong impression or impression that I did not intend. And this, I think, is an important area to understand. There is so much pseudoscience and woo surrounding the misunderstanding of energy. I want to talk just for a couple minutes about this topic. What we're talking about is the fact that, you know, the mass energy equivalence, the E equals MC squared, and that anything which is a source of energy, where actually you're creating energy from fuel, is obeying that law, whether it's chemical or nuclear or matter, antimatter, annihilation. Some people are under the false impression, I actually have, even in some science textbooks, are vague on this or incorrect on this. And, you know, reading about this question on the web, there was even a science teacher got this wrong, that in a chemical reaction that generates energy, the mass energy equivalency holds up too. So yes, you get a certain amount of energy at a chemical reaction, it must lose a corresponding amount of mass to correspond to the energy that's being created. And I said that that's the ultimate limiting factor in like how much energy you can store in a device like a battery. I did not mean to imply that this is an ultimate physical limitation of the universe, meaning that the amount of mass you would need for an energy, even if you had 100% conversion, would be limiting, because that even a tiny amount of mass, if converted 100% to energy, would produce an enormous amount of energy. One ballpark figure to give you an idea to help you visualize this: if you had about a gram of mass and you converted it 100% into energy, that would be the equivalent amount of energy that is released in launching the space shuttle into orbit. So this, you know, the space shuttle uses a chemical reaction, so you're getting energy out of a chemical reaction, and you have to fill that huge tank, obviously, with fuel. And that's about that's pretty efficient as chemical reactions go. But if you were using just 100% conversion, like matter antimatter annihilation, which is almost 100%, then you would need just a tiny little bit of mass, like a gram. A battery that had enough energy to last for 30 years wouldn't, if you were extracting the energy out of it with a high degree of efficiency, wouldn't have to weigh hardly anything at all. But the thing you have to understand is that there's only certain ways you can get energy out of mass. And they fall into several categories. Either it's a chemical reaction. Molecules are reacting, and they're going from some high-energy configuration to a lower-energy configuration, and the energy that is being stored in the electrical bonds is being released. There's a corresponding very, very tiny drop in mass, and you get energy out of that process. So one way to look at efficiency is how much of the mass you have is being converted into energy. For chemical reactions, it's minuscule. So if a chemical reaction is your source of energy, then you need a lot of mass for the amount of energy that you get out. And if you're going to try to store more energy, it's going to take more mass, because there are ultimate limits to how much energy you can get out of chemical reactions, because there's only so much energy that could be stored in those types of bonds. If you want to get more energy out of the same mass, then you have to actually go up to a different kind of process. You have to go to a nuclear process. The two basic kinds of nuclear process are fusion and fission. A fission, where you're separating either neutrons or protons, you get about a 0.1% conversion of the mass into energy. And for fusion, it's about 0.3%. So still a very tiny fraction of the mass is being converted into energy. And then again, if you want to go beyond that, you have to go to matter-antimatter annihilation, where you're getting near 100%, but that practical uses of that are a long way off. We were talking, in the context of this battery, we were talking about beta decay. In beta decay, a neutron is decaying into a proton plus an electron and a neutrino. And the energy, there's a little bit of loss of mass from the neutron to the proton, and that mass is being converted into kinetic energy in the electron. And that's what is being captured in this battery. But again, that's a very tiny fraction of the overall mass of the system is being converted into energy, which is, again, the ultimate sort of mass energy inefficiency in this system. But I also use the word efficiency without really defining it. And when you break it down, there's a few different types of efficiency that we can talk about. One is just for any amount of mass that you have, what percentage of that can be converted into energy by the type of reaction that you're using. Again, it's tiny, tiny for chemical. It's 0.1 to 0.3% for nuclear, and it's near 100% for matter, antimatter. But there's also then, of the matter you have, how much of it actually undergoes that reaction. So, for example, for fissionable nuclear material, only about 40% of it actually undergoes fission. So that's another drop in efficiency. With a chemical reaction, not all of the chemicals go through the reaction. So only a subset of the actual matter you have there is actually going to undergo the reaction that's generating the energy. And then the final level of efficiency is this, is how much of that energy that gets produced does usable work, and how much is dissipated as heat. For the beta voltaic battery, I mentioned that it was 25% efficient, and what I meant by that was that only 25% of the energy that's produced generates an electrical current that could be used to run your computer theoretically, or run some device, and 75% gets dissipated at heat. That's very inefficient for a portable electrical battery device, because it's generating quite a lot of heat. To me, this has always been a very interesting area. What I find very, very helpful, whenever there's any kind of fantastical claim, new energy, free energy device, amazing energy device, it's always a helpful exercise to go through the process of thinking about where is the energy coming from exactly, and what's happening to that energy every step of the way. And if you can't make sense out of it, then there's probably something wrong with the claims that are being made. Or if the claims don't fit into one of these categories that I'm talking about, or seems out of proportion to what the source of the energy is, then it's probably because there is something wrong with the claims that are being made. The next email comes from Joshua McCurry, and he writes, "I want to begin by saying I generally consider myself a very grounded, down-to-earth guy. I don't drink the dojo Kool-Aid, as it were. However, I spent time studying jujitsu under an old Korean grandmaster who had dabbled in Qigong, among many other styles. Physically, for his age, his skill as a martial artist was exponentially better than his English, but on one particular night, he selected my friend to demonstrate what you would probably call magic. I don't have any video of him slamming a blade into his arm, and that's a strike against me, I know. But with extreme focus, he could render a person unconscious from a pace or two's distance. He would extend index and middle finger, place the other arm behind his back, and go through a very audible breathing routine as he focused. Within maybe 20 to 30 seconds, my friend would begin to teeter back on his heels and eventually slump to the ground. I was always the guy to catch him, and can say with absolute certainty that he was not only unconscious but also not breathing, or breathing faintly enough I couldn't detect it with my arms around him. He would quickly step forward, slide his arms under my friend and around his back, and then with two quick hits to his back, bring him back. I understand the skeptic is on constant vigil and in a state of disbelief, especially in a realm so overexploited by hacks and liars such as martial arts, but it was entirely and completely legit. Having known this individual since kindergarten, I can say without doubt he was not buying into something if it wasn't going to work. He wasn't folding to spare the teacher humiliation. He was out like a light. So take it for what you will. I don't buy into much myself and consider myself to be entirely rational, but I can see in no way how it could have been explained by anything other than what it was. Other mutual friends of ours had seen it themselves, and though just as rational, were and remain just as sold. It will always be something people can write off, and maybe rightfully so, but in this particular case, I can without hesitation assure you of its legitimacy. Either way, I figured a more down-to-earth account of martial arts magic might do good to weigh in against the BS that is indeed out there. Love the show. Keep it up. Well, thanks for the email, Joshua. This was in follow-up to our martial arts piece from last week where the guy cut into his arm thinking the chi would block it, and the master challenged a real martial arts fighter to a fight and got his butt whooped. But Joshua didn't send any video, but it's very easy to find it on YouTube, and I did find a few examples of what he is talking about. Have you guys seen any of these?
Oh, yeah, of course.
I know Jay and I were watching them together before. So this is called the DMAC Touch of Death, or DMAC Touch of Death.
But he didn't die.
No, and one of the masters on one of these videos explains that only the real masters are good enough to know how to keep people from dying. This technique is so powerful that if you don't do it with utmost control, you can accidentally kill people.
So inherently, so as you learn the talent, you have to kill a few people.
You would think that.
No. You start on dogs.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Yeah, animal experiments first.
But did dogs have the same chi lines that humans do?
Well, no, but you move up to pigs, and pigs are very similar.
So this is the claim that what these touch masters are doing is they're focusing the chi inside themselves, and then they are projecting it to their target, causing the chi energy in the target to stop. And then their organs stop working, and they collapse. They go unconscious. Then they will tap them on the back, which restarts their chi energy flowing again, and they're back to normal. And it is amazing to watch this happen. What's amazing is how people buy into this, how this has persisted as a cultural belief for so long, based on nothing but just suggestion. It is an incredible testimony, in my opinion, to the human condition and the power of suggestion.
Isn't like hypnotism, Steve?
It's similar. I've been to faith healings where people are slain in the spirit. Have any of you seen this?
Oh yeah.
Very similar. You know, the people are worked up. The faith healer comes over to them, lays their hand on their forehead or gestures to them, and they're given a cue. They know when they're supposed to be slain, and then people collapse. It looks very similar. I also noticed when people really collapse, they hit the ground like a sack of potatoes, and they do not protect themselves. That kind of collapsing often results in some kind of injury, even if it's just a bruising or a scraping. In these videos, you see the master going around again, doing the technique to his students, who fall one by one, and they all fall, all of them fall, while still protecting themselves on the way down. Any neurologist can tell you that is a sign of fakery. That's what people do when they fake collapsing.
Oh, but they could actually believe that they're collapsing.
Yes, absolutely, Jay. It does not mean they don't have insight. I mean, it does not mean that they have insight into the fact that it's not real. They can really believe it.
Okay.
Yet, Steve, on that specific point, you and I had a discussion a long time ago, and it was about people who were paralyzed, but they weren't really paralyzed. Yep. It was all in their head. And you were telling me about it was really fascinating that one of the tests you might do is to pick up their hand and hold it over their face.
Yeah.
And they'll subconsciously or whatever move their hand so it doesn't hit their face when you drop it.
Yeah, if their arm is really paralyzed, it'll drop right into their face. And if it's right. not really paralyzed, whether they have insight into it or not, it will fall just to the side of their face and they will not hit themselves in the face. This is exactly the same thing. If it's real, they will be hurting themselves. They will fall down. And again, if they're truly going as unconscious as they appear to be, they should be hitting the floor hard and hurting themselves. But they all fall in this semi-controlled fashion, like a theatrical
fall. You're
like,
I'm fainting. Oh, like yeah. that type of thing.
So it's fake. It's fake right there. I mean, that's pretty conclusive. One of the videos was of a local news show. Again, there's these typical local, news programs are horrible, horrible, horrible. But this one, I have to give them a little bit of credit. They were investigating a local Demok Touch of Death Master who, again, can do this power to his students, and they wanted to put him to the test. So he demonstrated on all of his students. Hey, it worked on every single one. Just worked like a charm. And the guy was explaining all of the chi nonsense about it. So then they had the guy do it on martial artists of a different style and a different school. And it didn't work on one of them. And then they had the guy do it on the reporter, the newscasters. Yeah. And it didn't work at all. And then he had the fancy explanation, oh, it only works on about 40% of the people, and these guys are athletes, and athletes can dissipate the energy, but not all your students. So apparently it only works on his own students, which, draw your own conclusion. That's drinking the dojo Kool-Aid, right? That's it.
Reddest of red flags.
So, Steve, getting back to the emailer, he seemed very convinced, like he seemed actually 100% certain that it was happening. Mm-hmm. In this instance... Mm-hmm. You would chalk this up to something very similar to this, that it's
suggestion, it's self-deception. Now, it's possible that there is a physiological component to this. It is possible to faint from a purely psychological stimulus, right? I mean, you all have the image of, this is like the cliche of the dainty lady who, when shocked, faints dead away. That can actually happen. I mean, people can faint from a psychological stimulus. Your brain can make you faint. That's called a vasovagal reaction. It could also have a physical stimulus, but it means that the vagus nerve, which innervates a lot of your viscera, also slows down the heart. So anything which stimulates your viscera, including shock or emotion or a terrible odor or something which causes profound nausea, for example, all those things, anything which stimulates the vasal nerve can slow down your heart, cause you to become cold and clammy and ashen and then pass out.
Oh, wait, Steve.
I've seen it happen to people many, many times.
Steve, a bad odor can do that?
Yeah.
I mean, you...
Oh, yeah.
Are you serious? Really? Like a fart can knock somebody out?
Well, yours may be, Jay. I mean,
but there's intense ramifications here. I mean, that's pretty serious. I mean, that could be used as a weapon.
A noxious enough odor can stimulate the vagal nerve sufficiently for that to happen. So it is
to stimulate
perfectly
the
vagal nerve.
Okay. Steve, is there a way to can a doctor stimulate the nerve like you could do it in the hospital?
Yes. Yeah. In fact,
manually.
Yes.
How do you do it?
You could manually stimulate the vagal nerve.
Well, more or less, there are receptors, baroreceptors, stretch receptors in the carotid arteries. Uh-huh. The carotid arteries are the ones that go from the heart up to the brain. This is just one of the feedback mechanisms. When the pressure inside those arteries gets too high, this is a mechanism to protect the brain from too much pressure. It stretches the arteries, and those receptors send signals to the heart to slow down. Uh-huh.
How long does it take you to stimulate?
So if you knew where to rub, you could rub these receptors in the arteries and cause somebody's heart to slow down. We do this sometimes if someone's heart is like abnormally fast. This is like a quick bedside way to slow down the heart. But you could also make somebody faint by doing it. And interestingly enough, one of the techniques, there are some of the techniques that the videos demonstrate are like from a foot apart where there's no physical touch. That's just pure suggestion. But another one involves slapping people curiously right over the carotid artery. I wonder if that's a coincidence or if that came about because every now and then you give them a little, you know, stimulus, they get vagal and pass out. That's perfectly plausible that that's happening. In any case, the emailer seemed to suggest that his friend was really out cold. It's possible that he, the belief that he was going to faint, the anticipation, whatever, caused him to become a little vagal and he passed out on cue. Who knows? But it's not necessary. And looking at the video of these students going down, they're not passing out from vasovagal collapse. They're just going down because
acting.
They think that they should be.
Yeah.
Just like being slain in the spirit.
It's interesting.
It's fascinating.
Huh. But Jay, you didn't know your farts could kill, huh?
Nope.
All right, well, let's go on to our interview. Joining us now is Mark Abrams. Mark, welcome to The Skeptic's Guide.
Hi, thanks for having me here.
Mark runs the Improbable Research website at improbable.com and also hosts the Ig Nobel Prize, which just gave out its 2007 awards. Is this, am I counting right, is this the 17th year you've done this?
Yeah, this was the 17th first annual Ig Nobel Prize ceremony.
That's right, the 17th first annual. So how did it go this year?
Went pretty well, I think. No deaths, no injuries we've heard of yet. 10 new winners, 7 of them were there, an 8th sent in a videotaped acceptance speech at a full crowd again, televised it on the net, and had a lot of people bouncing off each other in maybe useful ways.
And no chickens were harmed in the making of that show, right?
Oh, no live chickens were allowed in there, and we did have requests. There are people from a farm that has a chicken cam, and they were requesting to bring, I think, 17 chickens, come to think of it.
That would have been impressive.
But the Sanders Theater seems to have regulations prohibiting most live animals, especially 17 chickens, I guess, from attending events there. So we had to regretfully say that they couldn't come.
And just so our listeners know, every year there's a different theme to the Ig Nobels. And so this year was, of course, chickens. I especially enjoyed the chicken keynote speech, which was basically just chicken, 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 with really great visual aids. Did you write that, Mark?
No, Doug Zonker, the man who gave the talk, is the author of that. We published a longer version of that in the Annals of Improbable Research. The original version was about 6 pages long, consisted of nothing but the word chicken repeated with some graphs and other illustrations.
So you just read the abstract during the show?
No. Doug Zonker himself presented it, and it was the epitome of every PowerPoint presentation you've ever seen, except that he used only the one word over and over.
I see. Now, did you have a tic-tac-toe playing chicken for the show?
No, we didn't. There were any number of things that we just can't squeeze in. They're just time limitations are a terrible thing sometimes.
So before we talk about this year's winners, why don't you give us a little bit of background on what the Ig Nobel Prize Award is? Why did you start it? What's the whole shtick?
Okay. We've been doing this since 1991, give out 10 prizes a year. They go for something that's unusual among all the prizes I'm aware of. There's the one criterion, and just the one. It's for things that first make people laugh and then make them think. And what people think, that's up to them.
And so it's obviously it's a lampoon of the Nobel Prize Awards.
It's many things, and at the same time, it's bordering on nothing as well. It's paradox.
But these are all for legitimate research, or at least these are papers that people published.
I always wonder when people use words like legitimate applied to almost anything. These are they're not all for science, first of all, although many of them are. We also give out a literature prize every year, a peace prize. Some years we've given out prizes in art, all sorts of things. Pretty much any human achievement is in the running. We do insist that the people who get the prizes exist. They have to be real people, and they really have to have done this. We go to great lengths to provide documentation, so anyone who wants to learn more about these can very easily at least in most cases, very easily go and find more about them.
So that's another criterion. They have to actually exist.
Yeah, that's true. These are not fictional things. They will strike you at first as being not possible, but check into them and you'll discover that they're quite real.
Mark, originally, was this your idea?
More or less, yeah. 17, 18 years ago, I'd become the editor of a magazine, the forerunner of this one, and I suddenly found myself meeting all kinds of people who'd done very unusual things, and some of them had this quality that we now describe in just a few words. It took years to figure out how to boil that down to a few words, by the way. And it seemed to me a shame that most of these people, really nobody had heard of them, and chances were, or appeared to me, that nobody ever would. And worse in a way, it looked like they've done things that are so outstanding, or pick your direction, upstanding, downstanding, whatever, but so different from what anyone else had done that it really seemed a terrible shame that they would probably never, ever get any kind of official recognition from anybody, important or unimportant. So the IGs more or less grew from that. In the first year, we chose a few winners. It didn't occur to us that we could, if we talked to all of them, get most of them to come. So we only talked to a couple. I had mentioned it to somebody at MIT who immediately said, "Would you like to have it here?" So we had a place to have it that first year, and I invited four Nobel laureates to come and hand out the prizes, and they came, and people came, filled up the hall, and the whole thing went well and got some attention. And because it worked well that first year, it was easy the next year to do it on a bigger scale, and it's just kept growing ever since.
So I have to ask you the most obvious question. What is your favorite prize that you gave out to somebody?
I have many favorites. We've been doing this for 17 years now, and that means we've had about 170 prizes, and quite a few of those are lodged in my mind. So all I can do is yank out a few that frequently come up when I try to think about this question.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is, of course, Troy Hurtubise. Troy is the man who lives in North Bay, Ontario, and who spent a number of years building and personally testing a suit of armor that he hopes will protect him against grizzly bears. And I expect several of you have seen some of the films that were made of Troy conducting those tests.
Oh, yeah.
And Troy's still alive. I always feel that I ought to point out to people that no matter what they may think of Troy's decision to do this, that he is alive, and that there are very few people anywhere in the world who are that careful, that consistently, for that long.
Yeah, so he gets props just for surviving his nuttiness.
Yeah.
So I take it you've met him.
Oh, yeah. He's come down to the ceremony a couple of times.
What's he like in person?
Troy is a circus. He seems to have two halves. One half is he has an imagination and also a sense of honor, and sometimes that can be a dangerous combination. He will describe something and think of variations, and if he hears something coming out of his mouth that he's telling or promising another person, he really seems to feel duty-bound to act on it. And I think that might be part of the explanation for why this project of his grew from a little tiny thing into something that stretched 7 years and more and involved grizzly bears and titanium and being pushed off cliffs and having jeeps ram into him at 40 miles an hour and all that. And the other half, which is on display when there's an audience, is a showman. He just is captivating and really entertaining and really funny.
Now, are you aware, before I go on, of Troy Hurtubise's career after the bear suit, his Angel Light project?
Yeah, he was doing all sorts of things. The last few years, he has gone off in directions that appear to me to be not very fruitful.
Right.
I'll put it.
And for our listeners, he basically claims that he's invented a device with which you can see through walls or solid objects. So that's pretty far out there.
Of course, Alfred Nobel invented a device that does that. No, Nobel invented dynamite.
Oh, right. Yeah. That's right.
See through walls, put your hand through walls, everything.
And that's what funded eventually the Nobel Prizes.
That's right. Yep.
Mark, do you work full-time for this, or does this take up all of your time, or do you do something else?
Yeah, you sound like a relative. This is what I do. I edit the magazine, the Annals of Improbable Research. It comes out every couple of months. I organize the IGs. That's a year-round thing, which involves a large number of people. Write books occasionally, do a newspaper column every week, blog on the website, and go around and do some talks. I stay busy.
And how can people subscribe to the Annals of Improbable Research?
It's pretty easy. Just go to the website at improbable.com, and you can get a subscription there.
Who, other than Troy, what are some other top contenders for your favorites?
Kees Moeliker from Rotterdam in the Netherlands certainly is up there. And he also has become a close friend and a big part of the magazine. Kees is an ornithologist. He studies birds, and he works at a museum, Natural History Museum, in Rotterdam. And one day he noticed something unusual. That's what ornithologists try to do, notice the unusual things. And he took notes and pictures, and then he, 6 years later, I think, wrote it up and published a study. And what he noticed, and the subject of this study, was the what became the world's first scientifically documented case of homosexual necrophilia in the mallard duck.
Oh, God.
Uh-huh. Now, he seems like
he is online for anybody who wants to go and see the details.
This guy has video of this?
Not video, but he took his camera. So he took photographs of it.
Oh, my God.
And this happened right outside the window of the museum. So he was able to have a good vantage point. And he took notes for the entire 75 minutes of action.
That's unreal. That's awesome.
Oh, it's quite real. You can see the pictures.
Have you ever had anyone actually get mad for being presented one of the awards?
Well, yes. We do have a policy in most cases that we get in touch with the people who are chosen long in advance, and we give them the opportunity to quietly decline this honor if they have reason to.
Very few
ever turn it down. But we want to make sure, as sure as we can anyway, that we're not ever, even by accident, going to damage somebody's career or whatever. Now, if somebody is doing something that's going to damage their own career, I guess more power to them. And you know, if we can be of help to them, I suppose we will. All we do really is just describe things. Now, there are a few people who have gotten angry. One of them is one of the people that we did not get in touch with. Occasionally, we'll give a prize to somebody who's been so much in the news that a little thing like an Ig Nobel Prize is not conceivably going to affect them one way or another. And one of those people is a man probably familiar to all of you. His name is Jacques Benveniste.
Yep. Is he still the only two-time winner?
He's still the only multiple winner, yes.
Yep.
He won 2 Ig Nobel Prizes. And then he died. There is no connection directly between those things.
That we know of, yeah.
Yeah.
And just for the audience, he's a homeopath. He did homeopathic research, and his research was exposed by Randy and others as being largely a fraud, although it was more that his one or more of his texts were defrauding him, not necessarily that he was consciously committing fraud.
Well, he won his second prize for starting a company based in France that made the following offer in general, that if you want to purchase drugs, pharmaceuticals, rather than go to a drugstore, you could send them credit card information over the internet or by telephone, and then you could hook up a glass of water in your home to your computer or to the telephone, and they would send you drugs over the internet or over the phone lines.
Mm-hmm. Oh, boy, I read about that. That is the best money-making scheme I've heard of in a long time.
Well, I don't know how the company's done, so you'll have to check with them about that.
Well, whenever you could sell nothing and get money for it, I think any money, I guess, is icing on the cake. Can we hit a couple of the highlights from this year? One that caught my eye, I'll just bring up, I actually remember reading this article when it came out, was the extracting vanilla flavor from cow poop.
Yes, I'm not sure that's quite the technical phrase that we listed.
I was being pithy.
A chemist named Mayu Yamamoto from Japan, and she came over for the ceremony, and she found a way to extract vanillin, which is the fragrance and the flavoring, from cow dung. She seems both pleased at having done this this imaginative piece of chemistry, and ever so slightly sad because it appears so far that there's not a food company in the world that quite dares to use this, even though it's probably, she says, a cheaper way to produce vanilla than is currently used.
Did you have a favorite this year?
It's too early. I'm still drinking it in. There were a couple of moments on stage, certainly, that were favorites. One was with her prize. She gave her speech, and as you may know, we have a means of making sure that the winners don't talk for longer than about a minute. And after she gave her speech, we introduced Gus Rancatori, who owns Toscanini's Ice Cream. Toscanini's Ice Cream is maybe the best ice cream place in the Northeast United States. And he explained that in honor of Ms. Yamamoto, he had invented a new flavor of ice cream, Yamamoto Vanilla Twist. And we brought some of it on stage, and we served it to the five Nobel laureates who were sitting there, all of whom looked at it for a good long minute before they would touch it. And the audience started to chant, "Eat it, eat it, eat it," and goaded on they did. And then they appeared really happy.
Did you try any?
Yeah, it was really good ice cream.
And just to be clear, it was made from vanilla using this method.
All Gus will tell me is that it's a fine vanilla ice cream made from the best ingredients.
Okay.
Okay.
There were a couple I noticed where the original research was published in Nature, which is a fairly prestigious journal.
Mm-hmm. The Wrinkling paper, one of the three Wrinkling papers cited, the Wrinkling prize we're talking about is the physics prize this year, went to two people who studied how sheets become wrinkled, the physics and mathematics of it. And one of those papers was in Nature. I think another was in Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. And that publication had two prizes this year. They also published, did PNAS, the paper that explained the discovery that Viagra aids jet lag recovery in hamsters. That was the subject of the Aviation Prize. First time we've given an Aviation Prize. And the winner came up from Argentina to collect the prize.
Now, see, to me, that one wouldn't necessarily even ring any bells for me or strike me as funny as a medical, you know, person.
This is something we find over and over and over again, that whatever people do for a living or do seriously in some other way for a long time, in a surprisingly short time, they lose the ability to see what it looked like to them when they were new. And I've had several winners now who, when I made the phone call to inform them that they'd been chosen, told me that that phone call was the first time it had occurred to them that what they did might be funny.
Yeah.
Now, I'll mention a couple where that has happened. Three. One of them was the Wrinkling paper this year. Mm-hmm. The author I called knows about the Ig and wasn't terribly surprised. He's done all kinds of colorful research, but he was puzzled for a moment about whether people would find that at all funny. The two that I was thinking of that always come to mind because I remember the moments on the telephone were a British team that won the biology prize a number of years ago for a study called Courtship Behavior of Ostriches Towards Humans under Farming Conditions in Britain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I see where you're going with that.
Yeah, and that phone call was the first time they realized that it was.
It's true. You get into your whatever your area of research, and you're thinking of the implications of it, not necessarily the superficial sort of way that it.
Well,
makes
yeah,
sense.
And in that case, and in the one I'll mention in a moment too, the scientists were doing it in the first place because people in a particular industry, had a problem and came looking for somebody who could help make sense of it and maybe even help solve it.
That sounds like a serious problem.
The other one I was thinking of is a previous winner of the Ig Nobel Physics Prize. This was a team of, I think, seven people in Australia. They published a study which they called an analysis of the forces required to drag sheep across various surfaces. And the pictures in that are just as good as the title.
Yeah, so they wanted to know if they should be dragging their sheep across grass or gravel.
Linoleum.
Not so much that. These were, they have large buildings that they use for this, and they wanted to know, was there anything they could do with the floors that helped this along? And one of the main findings of the study was that sheep are easier to drag downhill than any other way.
Okay.
Duh. Okay.
That's good. It's good to know. The one that struck me, talking about like losing perspective on humor within your own field, you gave a lecture for us a few years ago, and you threw up a title of one paper. Everyone started laughing, and I didn't get it. It took me a while. And it was the use of nitroglycerin to help deliver babies. Everyone started laughing because the use of nitroglycerin to aid in delivering a baby. And it did. It really took me a while. I did not get what the joke was. Because, as a physician, you hear nitroglycerin, it's just another drug name. The fact that it sounds like an explosive was completely lost on me.
Well, let me try another on you. And this one is something that won an Ig Nobel Prize a few years ago. It's a machine invented by a couple named George and Charlotte Blonsky, who lived in New York City, and they got a patent for this, which you can look up. And they describe it as a device to assist women in giving birth. And their device consists of a large round table and some machinery. The woman, when she's ready to deliver her child, lies on the table on her back. They strap her down to the table, and then the table is rotated at high speed.
Oh, no.
God.
There you go. Oh, my God, that is a mess.
Now, Steve, is that something that is that something that seems perfectly logical from your point of view?
No, that's absurd.
Okay.
Now, do they have like someone on the 3 feet off the table with like a catcher's mitt to catch the baby like lined up?
That's a good question. When you look at the drawings, and I do urge you again, go look at the drawing. there is a net designed in there to catch the child, but
the baby.
I think a lot of people will look at that drawing and see that net and feel that maybe that's not the optimal way of doing it.
Well, there's also a safety cord in case the net fails.
There's lots of safety equipment built in, but even so, it's a complicated and possibly messy business.
Well, Mark, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much for giving us your time.
Well, thanks. I've enjoyed it, too. And do keep your eyes peeled for things that might win IGs. Based on what you've told me today, maybe you should adopt a different search strategy. Keep your eyes peeled for things that do not make you laugh.
Yeah, that might work better. That might work better.
God, he has you figured out real quick, Steve.
Yeah, we better end this interview right now.
Thanks so much, Mark. Out.
All right, Mark, take care.
Thanks, Mark.
Good night, Mark.
Thanks.
Good night.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with 3 science news items or facts, 2 genuine and 1 fictitious. And I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. We have a theme this week. The theme is time. Is everyone ready?
Ready.
Okay.
All ready.
It's a bad theme, though. It might not even exist for much longer.
That's true. We got to get it out of the way right now while we still have it.
Oh, there it goes.
Item number 1. A theoretical physicist has proposed a testable model of the universe with 2 time dimensions. Item number 2. New study suggests that humans evolved their upright body plan 15 million years earlier than previously thought, about 21 million years ago. And item number 3. Harvard linguistic scientists have created a mathematical model of language evolution that predicts that the past tense will eventually disappear from the English language. Evan, go first.
Okay. A theoretical physicist. So is that a physicist that only maybe exists? A theoretical physicist, testable model of the universe, 2 time dimensions. I'll move on. Study suggesting human evolved the upright body plan 15 million years earlier than previously thought. Yeah, you know, I think that one's science because we're constantly revising, you know, the dates of when humans evolved and did this and did that. And those numbers always seem to move around a lot. So I'll say that that's science. Harvard linguistic scientists have created a mathematical model of language. Eventually, past tense will disappear. Yeah, I'm having a hard time accepting that one, and I think it comes on the heels of our discussion recently about languages disappearing and so forth, but I don't know, the past tense of language, I don't know, strikes me as a little odd, so I'll say that that one is the fiction.
Okay, Rebecca?
I'm kind of torn about this because I think that the past tense thing is possible, but I feel like I read something about this that was similar but not that. But I don't remember. So, I don't know. I'm going to take a guess. I'm going to say that that's the fiction as well.
Okay. Jay?
Well, the first one, I just can't imagine, you know, I couldn't imagine the comment that we brought up earlier in the show. I can't wrap my head around the two time dimensions thing. I'm trying to make it make sense, but it's totally worthless for me to even try. I can't think through it. So that's just a big question mark. You know, them being off 15 million years doesn't really shock me, but it is I don't know enough about that either, and I definitely didn't read anything about that. The Harvard linguistic scientists disappear from the English language. The past tense is going to disappear from the... What? That's ridiculous. How could we not talk about the past tense? The past tense is going to disappear. That doesn't make any sense. I'm going with that.
Well, there are other...
I'm going with it. I'm with it.
All right, so you guys are all agreed this week.
Well, oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so we'll take them in order. Since cool. You all agreed on the last one. First one, a theoretical physicist has proposed a testable model of the universe with two time dimensions. After that news item, I could pretty much say anything right now about theoretical physics, and you guys would probably buy it. But, you know, maybe we have a fifth dimension coming out of a four-assed monkey. This
wow,
one, however,
that was very quotable. A fifth dimension coming out of a four-assed monkey? Is that what you said?
And you guys are
talk about the singularity.
This one, however, is science. This is science.
Okay. I knew that.
Yes, this is Itzhak Barz of the University of Southern California in Los Angeles has a model of the universe which includes two time dimensions. He is concerned that his hypothesis, although he says it makes predictions that can be tested, didn't describe what they were, I probably wouldn't understand them anyway. It does raise some interesting problems because he suggests that if this were true, it would enable time travel. And that would cause the whole grandfather paradox. You know, what if you go back in time and kill your own grandfather? And the laws of the universe seem to be set up in such a way that they prohibit paradoxes from occurring. So physicists don't like that. They don't like situations that allow for paradoxes. But what he's looking into now is whether or not you can have two time dimensions, but travel in the second dimension would be so constrained that it would prevent any of this funky time travel paradox stuff. And apparently this would lead to some way of testing the theory. The next news item. New study suggests that humans evolved their upright body plan 15 million years earlier than previously thought, about 21 million years ago.
Good luck, everyone.
This one is science.
Yeah.
Congratulations, everyone. The title of this paper, Homeotic Evolution in the Mammalia, Diversification of Therian Axial Seriation and the Morphogenetic Basis of Human Origins. You guys got that?
Yep.
Yep.
So
perfect.
Yes, cephalothorax, something or other.
Yeah, I missed the middle part there. But homeotic refers to genes that regulate body segments, like so whole thing. It regulates other genes, like the production of a limb, and a limb can appear or not appear based upon this one homeotic sort of regulatory gene. So there's a lot of genetic and evolution research that involves looking at these genes because they're obviously very important to basic body plans. And when one species branches off from another with a completely new body plan or with some significant change in the body plan, that probably means that there was a change or a mutation in a homeotic, you know, regulatory gene. So These researchers were looking at the branch of the human line from the other apes, and they said that, well, the one thing that we know is different about humans is our upright posture, and this relates to a morphological change in the lumbar spine that is different from all other primates, and all other mammals, in fact. So they said, since that is a morphological feature unique to our lineage, maybe we could find the homeotic gene mutation that causes it, and if then we can date that mutation, we'll find the branch point of humans from other primates. That's what they did, and they came up with 21 million years as the date. It also puts the actual species, the fossil species, that may have represented the first branch point for our line was a Miocene hominoid called Morotapithecus. Now, again, this is one line of evidence. This has to be triangulated with other lines of evidence, you know, fossil and other genetic evidence to see if the date holds up. But it did push it back significantly from where our fossil evidence leads. But the fossil evidence really, we hit a huge gap once you get up to about 8 million years. All of this means that the last item, Harvard linguistic scientists have created a mathematical model of language evolution that predicts that the past tense will eventually disappear from the English language, is fiction. And Rebecca, you are correct.
Is it the subjunctive?
No, nothing's going to disappear from the English language. What they looked at, these are Harvard linguists who are developing a mathematical model for following the changes in languages over time, the evolution, if you will, of languages. And they're trying to, like, for the first time, really mathematically model how the changes take place over time, and they're coming up with some interesting things. What they did find, model mathematically, this is something that was already known, but they were able to model it, is what happens with a language over time is that early on there may be a lot of exceptions to a specific rule, and then over time there is pressure to regularize, which means that the exceptions all get dropped over time. And this, they were looking at the past tense. The most common rule for making a word past tense is to add the ed at the end. But apparently there were many exceptions. If you go back to the Old English, there were seven competing rules for verb conjugation into the past tense. Six of them have gradually faded from use over time, and then the suffix ed has won out, if you will, as the dominant rule for making past tense. So they were modeling how this happens over time. One of the things they found, for example, is that a verb used 100 times less frequently will evolve 10 times as fast. That's one of the mathematical rules they discovered. So the less frequent it's used, the more quickly it will change.
I think it might have to do with, like, if you think of a word or phrase that it only happens to catch your eye, like on the SATs or something, it's that word that normally gets misused later on because people just don't understand the definition.
You know what I always wanted to know? Did anyone actually speak like, "That's right, Copper, yeah"? Like,
yes, Edward G. Robinson.
Were people walking around, like, what, in the 20s, like, talking to each other like
that? You
know
what, Jay? I've definitely noticed that if you look at films from, like, the 40s,
yeah,
like the 30s and 40s when you first really had, like, audio film,
yeah,
people had a certain accent that you don't hear in anyone alive today. It wasn't a regional accent. And I've often wondered, is that because they're uncomfortable in front of the camera? Or was that the way people spoke back then? Are we seeing now, for the first time, are we seeing a temporal accent?
It's other, you know, a little less on point, but another interesting thing. I had found out about a year ago that, like, the whole pirate speak, you know, all that stuff, that's definitely from the movies.
Yeah, wasn't that from Treasure Island or something? Wasn't there a specific movie that really generated most of what we think of as the cheesy pirate stuff?
Yeah, no, but people actually didn't live and speak like that.
So, Jay, you're telling me that there was no one-eyed, you know, peg-legged, parrot-carrying, swashbuckling pirate that said, "Arr."
No, I mean, it's terrible if you say, I did, at one point in my life, kind of fantasize about how cool pirates were and stuff like that, I guess as a kid. You know, there's something kind of cool about it, roguey and cool. But last no, Steve.
We need a pirate historian to come on the show and clarify for us.
A pirate linguist.
A piratologist. Any piratologist out there, let us know.
Yeah, let's dig into it a little bit. I'm just, you know, that is definitely coming out of my memory, but I'm pretty sure I'm correct.
Evan.
Hi.
Hello.
I'm dying to know the solution to your limerick from last week.
Oh, yeah. Well.
Come on, hurry up.
I don't know. Why don't I reread the limerick first?
And, in proper meter,
we'll talk
please.
About the answer. For a feline and fowl he is known, the styling for years he had grown. Auras foretold his seizures. In the meantime, his leisures would yield fame from these seeds he had sown. Whom is this describing? It is describing none other than the infamous Mr. Edward Lear, who was an English author from the 19th century who popularized the modern limerick, as we all know and adore it and love it today.
Oh, excellent.
And so just running through the puzzle real quick, the feline and fowl he is known. He is the author of the famous story, The Owl and the Pussycat. The styling for years he had grown. The limerick, of course, is his styling that he had grown. Or as foretold his seizures. Now, this is kind of the curveball I threw in there because I figured people might get thrown off a little bit about auras and seizures and, you know, how auras kind of have a pseudoscientific connotation to them. But actually, Steve, as you explained to me, mm-hmm. auras are an actual occurrence in the context of a seizure.
Yes, an aura, in fact, is a seizure. It is the early part of a seizure where a person could be conscious. It will cause some bizarre sensation. You could smell something weird or see things in your vision or maybe hear something or just have a weird feeling or feel separated from reality. Those are auras. And then if that seizure spreads, it could then lead into like a full generalized seizure where you twitch and become unconscious. So people think it's something that happens before the seizure, but actually it's just the beginning part of a seizure.
And Edward Lear suffered from many seizures from early on in life and right through his life and constantly kind of hampered his health mm-hmm. as it went on. So that was the curveball. In the meantime, his leisures, such as his limericks. And he was also a famous artist. He used to paint birds, mostly owls and other birds and so forth. And he was compared to the likes of Audubon. And through his paintings and through his stories and through his limericks, these were the seeds he had sown, and hence his fame.
Well done. And our winner is?
The winner this week is Flighty from the message boards.
Good job, Flighty.
Congratulations.
Well done, Flighty. Well done.
Evan, do you have a puzzle for us this week?
I do. Deserted some time ago from a plain red place, as Pluto crossed the sky, four horses led the way. Gazing down on all the animals, it seemed improbable that the animals made them. Despite the insistence of the AA crowd, foreign visitors were not responsible. What is it?
Interesting as always.
Something to wrap your mind around, and good luck, everyone.
Thank you, Evan.
Enjoy.
Now, last week, we challenged our audience to send us skeptically themed limericks in honor of Evan's excellent limericks that he gave us. And we did have quite a few submissions, so thank you, everyone, for sending in your limerick submissions.
Mm-hmm.
But we decided, however, to extend the contest another week, largely because the quality of these limericks were...
varied.
Varied. They were limited in...
People.
They were challenged.
I laughed at a lot of submissions.
I laughed, yeah.
No, I'm not going to say that I'm a limerick snob, but I am. Okay, give me a good meter, people. Come on. Do your homework.
Yeah,
there once was a man from Nantucket. Just keep that in your head, okay?
A lot of them departed significantly from the style of the limerick.
I think we got a few sonnets. Come on.
Yeah.
It's the limerick.
So you know, mine departed too, I must admit.
That's why I'm saying it's your fault, Evan.
Yeah, I blame Evan. So we're going to give you guys another week to submit more limericks and maybe clean up some of the ones that you sent us. There were some good ones in there. definitely mm-hmm. some good ones in there, but I think that we haven't tapped this potential yet, so we'd like to give you guys another week.
And we're each going to come up with one, right?
Well, now you've said it. Now we got to do it. We will come up with our own.
Don't let us show you people up. Come on, guys. Yeah. Send them in.
All right, Jay, give us a quote to close out the week.
I do. I have a quote sent in by Paul Reinerfeldt. Paul, I hope I pronounced your name right. He's from Sweden. And Paul quotes Kurt Vonnegut, who is a U.S. novelist, 1922, 2007. Oh, he died this year? When did he die?
Yeah, earlier this year.
This year, yeah.
Interesting. Anyway, Kurt Vonnegut says, "Those who believe in telekinetics, raise my hand." Kurt Vonnegut!
Kurt!
That's a damn good quote.
I bet you that would work really well live. Well, thanks, everyone.
Thanks, Steve.
Thank you, Steve.
Thanks, Doctor.
A pleasure, as always.
For us, too.
This was fun.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and SkeptChick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.